Welcome to the Depth Dive. Today, we're getting right into it. We're exploring the critical science of emergency trauma care, specifically the fight to maintain circulation when someone's facing, well, major bleeding.
Yeah, life-threatening hemorrhage.
Exactly. Our sources today are all focused on how things go wrong, the anatomy, the physiology of shock, and importantly, the emergency protocols designed to keep things running when every second counts. So our mission is pretty clear. We're extracting the absolute must-know rules, the thresholds, the priorities that save lives in these situations.
Mm-hmm.
And let's start with maybe the most counterintuitive rule right off the bat. For anyone in trauma care, you know, the standard ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation. Well, in massive hemorrhage, the sources hammer this home. It gets flipped. The principle is A before B, except after C.
That phrase is absolutely key.
Mm-hmm.
Circulation first, then airway and breathing. But only if there's massive uncontrolled bleeding.
Because stopping that bleed is the most time-sensitive thing.
Precisely. If you don't have blood circulating, messing with the airway doesn't help much, does it? The ultimate goal is perfusion, getting oxygenated blood to the tissues. Without flow, nothing else matters.
Okay, that really drives home how crucial circulation is. So let's break down the why. Hmm. Why is keeping that flow going so fundamental minute by minute?
Well, think of the cardiovascular system as, like, the body's main transport network. It needs three things to work. The pump, that's the heart.
Right.
The pipes, the blood vessels. And the fluid, the blood itself.
Makes sense.
If any one of those fails or even just slows down significantly, oxygen delivery stops. Almost instantly, tissues get swamped with waste products.
And they start to suffocate, essentially.
Yeah, they switch to anaerobic metabolism working without oxygen, and cells literally start dying. We're talking minutes here. Not hours. It's incredibly fast.
We often focus on the amount of blood loss, the volume, but the quality of that fluid matters too, right?
Yeah.
What exactly are we losing when we bleed?
Oh, absolutely. You're losing much more than just red cells. Blood is mostly plasma. That's the watery, straw-colored part.
Okay.
But floating in that plasma are the formed elements. Red cells carry oxygen. White cells fight infection. And then there are the platelets.
Ah, platelets. Crucial for clotting, I remember.
Exactly. They're tiny cell fragments, but they're essential for starting the whole clotting process.
Mm.
You see, coagulation making a stable clot, it's like a chemical reaction. It needs those platelets, specific proteins in the plasma called clotting factors, and interestingly, calcium.
So when you lose volume,
you lose it all. You lose the fluid, the cells, the platelets, the factors. The whole self-repair system just grinds to a halt if the loss is too great.
Okay, let's shift to the tump, the heart. How does it cope when volume starts dropping fast? We hear terms like preload and afterload. Is the heart itself failing, or is it just not getting enough fuel, so to speak?
It's mostly the latter. It's being starved of returning blood. The heart's actually very efficient, but it can only pump out what comes back in.
Mm-hmm.
Preload is basically that. The amount of blood filling the heart, ready to be pumped, when you're bleeding, preload tanks.
And afterload.
Afterload is the resistance the heart pumps against the pressure in the aorta that has to overcome to push blood out.
Got it. So the heart's overall work, cardiac output, that's calculated how to come?
Simple formula. Mm-hmm. Stroke volume, the amount pumped per beat, times the heart rate.
Okay.
And what's interesting is how the body tries to compensate. A healthy heart normally pumps out the same percentage of blood that returns to it.
So if less comes back?
If less comes back, the stroke volume drops. So the body's immediate reaction, driven by the sympathetic nervous system, is panic. It releases adrenaline.
And that makes the heart beat faster. Tachycardia.
Exactly, tachycardia. That increased heart rate is the first, the earliest sign the body's trying to compensate for the volume loss. It's trying to maintain that cardiac output.
So that initial speed up, the tachycardia, it buys some time, but it can't last forever, obviously. Why does that compensation eventually fail? It seems like a smart response.
It is smart, but it's a short-term fix running against a losing clock.
Mm.
The autonomic system also tries to squeeze the blood vessel's vasoconstriction to keep pressure up.
Mm-hmm.
And the endocrine system releases hormones like ADH and aldosterone to try and hold on to whatever fluid is left.
But it's not enough.
It's often not enough because the core problem remains not enough volume and therefore not enough oxygen carriers hemoglobin. Perfusion, delivering that oxygen, depends on adequate heart rate, yes, but also stroke volume, hemoglobin, and oxygen saturation.
Mm.
When the volume loss is just too severe, speeding up the heart burns more energy but doesn't actually refill the pump effectively. The compensation becomes inefficient.
Okay, that makes sense. So where is that breaking point? How much blood loss can the body actually handle before we go from compensating to decompensating, heading towards collapse?
This is a critical number, really important. The sources consistently point to this. The body generally cannot tolerate losing more than 20% of its total blood volume.
20%? Wow.
Yeah. That's the tipping point. For an average adult, losing over a liter of blood is usually enough to cause significant changes in vital signs. That's when you really start seeing the slide into decompensated shock.
That 20% figure really puts the speed of trauma into perspective, doesn't it? When we see bleeding, how do we quickly assess how dangerous it is? What are the visual clues?
Well, first we think about the type of vessel. Arterial bleeding is the most dramatic, bright red blood spurting in time with the pulse. That needs immediate control.
Right, the highest pressure.
Exactly. Venous bleeding is darker red, flows steadily, maybe gushes a bit, but doesn't spurt. Capillary bleeding is slower, dark red, more of an ooze from the surface.
And the venous and capillary stuff, that's more likely to clot on its own.
Much more likely, yeah.
Yeah.
Generally, that type of bleeding might stop within about 10 minutes if pressure is applied. Arterial bleeding, not so much. It often needs more intervention.
But what about the bleeding we can't see? Internal hemorrhage. That sounds terrifyingly hidden.
It is. And it can be from trauma, like a shattered spleen or liver or non-traumatic causes. Think ruptured aortic aneurysms, major gastrointestinal bleeds, or even a ruptured ectopic pregnancy in women.
So how do you even know?
You have to suspect it based on the mechanism of injury, like a high-speed crash or a significant fall. Or if the patient just looks pale, weak, feels faint, you know, signs of shock without obvious external bleeding.
And the treatment for that.
If you suspect significant internal bleeding, there's only one real fix. Surgery, definitive care. That patient needs rapid transport.
Okay, so that internal bleeding or massive external bleeding pushes the body towards a bigger crisis. Let's talk about hemostasis, the body's attempt to stop the bleeding itself. How does that work and why does it fail in severe trauma?
Hemostasis is actually quite elegant in three main steps.
Mm-hmm.
First, the injured blood vessel spasms and constricts vasoconstriction to reduce flow.
Okay.
Second, platelets rush to the site and stick together, forming a temporary plug. That's platelet aggregation.
Like the platelets we mentioned earlier.
Exactly. And third, a protein called fibrin forms a mesh over that plug, creating a stable, more permanent clot.
Sounds effective. So why does it fail? Obviously, conditions like hemophilia where you're missing clotting factors.
Right. That's a pre-existing failure point. But in major trauma, the system gets overwhelmed for other reasons. This leads us to something really critical called the trauma triad of death.
The trauma triad of death? That sounds ominous.
It is. It's a vicious cycle. A lethal combination of three things happening at once. Hypothermia, low body temperature.
Yeah.
Coagulopathy, the inability to clot properly. And acidosis. Too much acid in the blood from poor perfusion.
And they feed into each other.
They absolutely do. It works like this. Major bleeding leads to shock. Shock makes the patient lose heat, so they become hypothermic.
Okay.
Crucially, a cold body cannot clot effectively. Hypothermia directly messes up the function of platelets and those clotting factors. So the patient develops coagulopathy.
Which means they bleed more.
Exactly. More bleeding worsens the shock, worsens the hypothermia, and also worsens perfusion, leading to a buildup of metabolic waste products. That's acidosis.
And the acidosis probably makes clotting even harder, too.
It does. It inhibits clotting enzymes. So you're stuck in this downward spiral.
Mm-hmm.
Bleeding makes you cold. Being cold stops you clotting. Not clotting makes you bleed more, which makes you colder and more acidotic. It's the cascade.
Wow. Okay. So that's the triad driving things downhill. This cycle pushes the patient through different stages of shock, right? From compensated towards irreversible.
Correct. We classify hemorrhagic shock, which is shock caused by bleeding. Initially, it's compensated, the body's keeping up, like with that tachycardia we talked about.
Right.
Then it becomes decompensated, the body's mechanisms are failing, blood pressure drops. And finally, irreversible shock, where cell damage is too widespread for recovery.
What are the signs we should look for? You mentioned tachycardia is early. What tells us things are getting worse moving into decompensated shock?
As shock progresses past simple tachycardia, you'll see increasing weakness, maybe fainting or dizziness. The patient's eyes might look dull, unfocused, but a key indicator is altered mental status.
Confusion, lethargy.
Yes, confusion, restlessness, anxiety, eventually becoming unresponsive. Once the brain isn't getting enough oxygenated blood, their level of consciousness declines. That's a very bad sign. You're definitely in decompensated shock then.
Okay, so recognizing these signs is vital. Knowing that internal bleeding needs surgery and this triad is looming, it brings us right back to that CAB priority and immediate action. What are the absolute must-dos for managing bleeding, especially externally, while getting the patient to help?
First, that primary survey has to hit C immediately if there's massive external bleeding. Stop that first.
Right.
And if you suspect significant internal bleeding based on how the injury happened or how the patient looks, rapid transport is key. The sources strongly suggest scene time shouldn't be more than 10 minutes in severe trauma. Get them moving.
10 minutes. Okay. Let's talk tools for external bleeding. Direct pressure is step one, always.
Always start with firm, direct pressure right on the wound. Use gauze, a clean cloth, whatever you have. That works for a lot of bleeding.
But if it's severe arterial bleeding from an arm or leg,
then you need a tourniquet. If it's bleeding heavily from a limb, somewhere below the armpit or the groin, a tourniquet is potentially life-saving.
Are there specific rules for using them? I know there used to be some controversy.
Modern tourniquets are very effective when used correctly. Key rules. Apply it above the wound, closer to the torso. Make it tight enough to stop the arterial bleeding completely. It will be painful.
Okay.
Use a proper commercial tourniquet if possible. If you have to improvise, use wide material, at least a couple of inches. Never use anything narrow like wire or string that just cuts tissue.
Right. Distribute the pressure.
Exactly. And don't apply it directly over a joint like an elbow or knee because you won't be able to compress the artery against the bone there.
And crucially, once it's on tight and the bleeding stops,
do not loosen it. Write down the time you applied it. Leave it on until someone at the hospital or medical control tells you otherwise. Loosening it can cause massive reperfusion problems.
Okay, don't loosen it. Got it. What about bleeding in those tricky spots, like the groin or the armpit, where a standard tourniquet won't fit?
Yeah, those are junctional areas. For those, you might use specialized junctional tourniquets. They look more like big belts with compression devices. Or you use hemostatic agents.
Those are the special dressings.
Right. Gauze or granules impregnated with substances that help blood clot quickly. You pack them deep into the wound, right onto the source of bleeding, and then apply strong pressure over the top. They work by chemically promoting clotting or by absorbing water from the blood very rapidly.
Useful for those awkward spots.
Very. And one other thing for bleeding control, often overlooked initially, is splinting.
Splinting? For bleeding?
Absolutely. Think about a broken femur, the big thigh bone. Those sharp bone ends can easily tear muscles and critically large blood vessels nearby. That can cause massive internal bleeding within the thigh.
Ah, I see. So stabilizing the fracture stops further damage.
Precisely. Immobilizing a significant fracture with an air splint, a traction splint for a femur, or even just rigid splints is a key part of hemorrhage control.
That's a really important connection. Okay, so that covers external control. For suspected internal bleeding, we know it's all about speed to surgery. But what care can we provide en route? How do we manage shock itself?
While you're transporting rapidly, the focus is on supporting the patient's remaining circulation and preventing that trauma triad from worsening.
So what does that involve?
Keep them warm. Cover them with blankets. If you have IV access, use warm fluids, not cold ones. This directly fights the hypothermia leg of the triad.
Okay, warm fluids. Makes sense. Anything else?
Give them nothing by mouth, no food or water. They might need surgery soon. Minimize any unnecessary movement. Keep them as still as possible.
And monitor them closely.
Constantly. If they're in severe shock, you should be checking vital signs, heart rate, blood pressure if possible, breathing, mental status every 5 minutes, en route to the hospital. Things can change very, very quickly.
Wow. That really paints a picture of constant vigilance. It all circles back, doesn't it? From recognizing the CAB switch to managing the triad with things like warmth and rapid transport.
It really does. It shows how understanding the underlying physiology, why bleeding kills, how the body fails, directly informs the emergency actions you have to take.
So this deep dive started with that crucial reversal, C before A and B in catastrophic hemorrhage. We've gone through the system, the pump, pipes, fluid, seeing how the body tries and often fails to compensate.
And the interventions needed.
Right, up to the specific tools and priorities like tourniquets, hemostatic, splinting, and crucially, rapid transport and warmth for shock. What still stands out, though, is that unforgiving number, that 20% threshold. It shows how life really hangs by a thread, how losing what seems like a manageable amount of blood can trigger that devastating spiral.
Especially when you factor in something as simple as getting cold. The link between hypothermia and coagulopathy, driven home by the trauma triad concept, is just so critical.
Yeah, it shows emergency care isn't just about plugging holes. It's about managing the whole internal environment, temperature, chemistry, to allow the body's own repair systems to even have a chance.
Could have said it better myself.
Which leaves us with a final thought for you, our listener. We saw how something seemingly secondary, like body temperature, is absolutely essential for a primary life function clotting to work correctly in trauma. So think about your own world, maybe your work, or any complex system you rely on. What crucial, maybe overlooked, secondary factor, environmental, chemical, procedural, whatever, are you potentially neglecting right now? Something that, if it failed, could cause your main operation to just seize up, even if all the core parts seem okay. Something to ponder. Thank you for joining us for this vital deep dive.
Stay safe out there.
We'll see you next time.